Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Again, I'm Dean Reuter, Senior Vice President, General Counsel of the Federalist Society, still Dean Reuter. Welcome to the third and the best day of the Federalist Society's 40th anniversary National Lawyers Convention. If you have not been, how many of you have been to the South Carolina room to see the rare documents exhibit? Okay, that's impressive. But if you have not been there, or if you haven't heard of this, you're going to have one more day to get up there and view some really rare documents. I was able to hold and leaf through a 1350 Magna Carta, and there are many other documents up there. The people who have been through are wowed by it. It's a real opportunity to see these documents, but also to interact with them. So I encourage you to get up there. We're also having a first ever, as far as I know, National Lawyers Convention drawing where you can win a leaf of the first edition Federalist Papers. To do that, you need to go through the room and drop a business card or use the QR code to get yourself registered for that. And that's, you have to do that before 1 p.m. today. I want to thank the Jack Miller Center and the Remnant Trust folks for carting up all that, the documents you see. There are dozens of them. They come to us from Indianapolis by truck. So, you know, it's a beautiful room up there. It's a beautiful display, but I imagine them, you know, working long hours to cart it up, drive it here. I don't know how they do that with these rare documents, and then unload it and set it all up. So it's a brilliant display. I really urge you to take a moment out of your day and see it. And now, to make a special presentation, we have some folks from the Remnant Trust. There's Chris. It looks like Chris Talley's coming up, but we have Chris and Liza. But come on up, please.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and thank you in particular to the Federalist Society, and to all of you who have had the time to come by and taken the time to come by and view our collection. I join Dean in inviting you up today to do so and engage with those works. This foundation was founded 30 years ago, and the purpose was to share great works to inspire great ideas and have those ideas endure and return us to first principles of sound constitutional government. I also join you, Dean, in thanking the Jack Miller Center for their sponsorship of this event. That's very much appreciated. That's a fine organization, one I know well. So now I have the pleasant duty of sharing our commemorative piece with the Federalist Society. I want to present to you, Dean, on behalf of the Remnant Trust, an expression of our appreciation commemorating this on this the occasion of your 40th meeting and the success of the organization throughout the years. So we are commemorating 40 years of the Federalist Society with great appreciation from the Remnant Trust. And what we have here is also a framed leaf of the Federalist Papers, original 1788 edition. On occasion, from time to time, the Remnant Trust has come into possession of these leaves by people that we either purchased them from or that they're gifted to us. They're from documents that have been destroyed or in the process of being thrown away, and so we are able to salvage certain pieces of that work and in some small way preserve its importance to this great experiment in liberty. Dean, it's my pleasure. Congratulations, and thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris. This is really something. I hope my enthusiasm for this whole undertaking comes through clearly, and I hope you really do get up to the South Carolina room. I'm going to ask that we take this up there so the folks that are going through the room can see this, and then with your promise that we'll actually get it back. Good. And I promise you I could read a few lines of this and figure out which Federalist Papers this is, but not without my reading glasses. So. And this is really handsomely done and really formidable, and I don't know if you can see, but it's front at the front and the back of the page, so well done. And thank you again. For now, though, we're going to continue the exploration of our convention theme with our first showcase panel of the morning, the current state of the legal profession, with a panel on the adversarial system. And of course, that reminds me of a very brief story. Were those laughs or groans? I couldn't really tell. Now, this story might not quite go to the heart of the adversarial system, but it's the best I can do. It actually concerns what happens when there is no adversarial system and all the travails that can follow from that. Then this story concerns my wife, who I think is not in the room. So it's important that none of you repeat this story to her. And I hereby retain you all as pro bono lawyers, so this is attorney-client privilege material, even if you're on the live stream. This story involves COVID, the epidemic that has ended. And I will say, during COVID, I traveled pretty extensively, and I hung out with tens of you, hundreds of you, sometimes thousands of you, in different parts of the country, different parts of the world even, and I never contracted COVID until earlier this year in March. I got COVID. And at that time, in March of this year, when I got COVID, the guidance was to isolate at home for 5 days. You might remember this. You isolate at home for 5 days, and then you can walk around freely, but with a mask for the next 5 days. So dutifully, I was at home, consigned to the spare bedroom for 5 days, isolating. My wife stayed in the much more luxurious master bedroom suite, while the ailing person, me, consigned to the more austere quarters of the spare bedroom. So far so good. I think that's fair. About 2 months later, unrelatedly, my wife contracted COVID and was forced to isolate at home for 5 days, still the same regime. So I was again consigned to our spare bedroom while she stayed in the much more luxurious master bedroom suite. So you can see where I'm headed with this, and you can see the importance of not repeating this story to my wife. There was no argument or discussion. There was no debate. I'm not sure how it happened, actually. There was no adversarial system to make this determination. Events just seemed to unfold in that way. So no recognition of the disparity of treatment. Anyhow, the adversarial system, you can all see clearly that that the result reached was viciously and wickedly unjust. So I'm professionally and personally in favor of the adversarial system that we're here to discuss today. And for that, we have a great panel moderated by Judge Kyle Duncan. Before I turn it over to the judge, I do want to remind folks of our one remaining housekeeping note. If you're seeking CLE, you need to click that CLE button, the QR code, to start your day. Otherwise, you'll have a problem with your bar association that we're not going to be able to help you with. Now, our first panel moderated by Judge Kyle Duncan. We're very pleased to have him, a personal friend. He sits on the Fifth Circuit, where he's been from early 2018. After receiving his undergraduate and JD from LSU, he got a Master of Laws from Columbia University. He clerked on the court for which he now serves, and he served in state government as well in private practice as the GC for the Beckett Fund, a named partner at Cher Duncan, now Cher Jaffe, here in Washington, D.C. We're very pleased to have him moderate our panel, and I thank the panelists in advance, and I thank Judge Duncan. If we could call the panel forward, please.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, everybody. What a great panel we have assembled for you. The title of this panel is Lawyers, the Adversarial System, and Social Justice. So let me just summarize the topic, and then I'll introduce our panelists and let them take over. The ABA Model Rule of Professional Responsibility 1.2b states, a lawyer's representation of a client, including representation by appointment, does not constitute an endorsement of the client's political, economic, social, or moral views or activities. And the comments go on to explain legal representation should not be denied to people who are unable to afford legal services or whose cause is controversial or the subject of popular disapproval. By the same token, representing a client, Lisa, are you already leaving the panel?
Yeah,
sorry. I haven't said anything offensive yet.
Offended.
I'm sorry. Representing a client does not constitute approval of the client's views or activities. These principles, as we all know, date back at least to John Adams' defense of the British soldiers involved in the Boston Massacre and have long been viewed as essential to the adversarial system. And when I was preparing for this panel this very early this morning, after being up very late with my clerks, and we had a lot of fun, and then I had to do the dishes. I was leafing through my John Adams biography by David McCulloch, which is a wonderful, wonderful book, to read about the account of the Boston Massacre and Adams' defense of the one captain and the eight soldiers, eight of whom were acquitted. Two were found guilty of manslaughter, which seemed to me a relatively mild punishment of having their thumbs branded. But Adams claimed that as a result of his, did I just say that? I mean, one would expect more harsh punishments at the time. Of course, today that would be an Eighth Amendment violation.
At least an interesting question for the court.
That's right.
I think we now know we're hearing from what's called a quote hanging judge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Seth, they weren't hanged.
I understand, but you seemed aggrieved by that.
One would have expected a harsher punishment than that. Adams claimed, as a result of the representation, that he lost half of his practice. And yet, he went on to say that the defense was, quote, one of the best pieces of service I have ever rendered my country. And so we have this as a norm, as not only in the rules of ethical responsibility, of professional responsibility for lawyers, but it sort of as a norm of what it means to be a lawyer. Increasingly, however, in the minds of some, these principles are better honored in the breach, at least in the case of the powerful. So there are all kinds of representation that lawyers, in some views, should simply not undertake. Defending Gitmo detainees, defending the Defense of Marriage Act, tobacco companies, oil companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Lawyers who undertake such representations, it's argued, should incur severe reputational and professional consequences, and other clients should punish firms to take on these matters by taking their business elsewhere, even if there's no direct conflict. To these minds, such representation sends the wrong message about the role of law in society. At the same time, in the view of many of the proponents of these exceptions, it remains essential that lawyers continue to represent certain kinds of unpopular clients, such as defendants accused of violent crimes, without fear of adverse professional repercussions. To them, that is fundamental, as it seems to have been to Adams, to the proper role for lawyers in society. So the panel is going to discuss these interesting and timely ideas. Can these two visions, if these are accurately representing what are two visions of the role of lawyer in our society, can they coexist? What is the proper role of the lawyer? Now, to discuss this question, I dare say we have an all-star panel, a wonderful panel. I was, again, this morning I was trying to print out the bios of these panel members, and I ran out of paper on my printer, I kid you not. And so I'm not going to read everything these august members of the legal profession have done, because it would take up all our time, and I don't want to do that. So I'll be very brief. You should read their bios. First we have, and I don't even remember the order that we're doing this in, but I'll say Paul Clement. We have, who's a partner at Clement and Murphy, which is a new firm. I've never heard of that firm. Paul served as the 43rd Solicitor General of the United States from June 2005 until June 2008. Before his confirmation, he served as Acting Solicitor General, and before that as Deputy Solicitor General. He's argued a few cases in the Supreme Court. I have to mention, having heard from Justice Barrett at the gala dinner, you clerked for Judge Silberman of fond memory on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and for Associate Justice Antonin Scalia. And you were a distinguished lecturer of law at Georgetown University. So we're delighted to have Paul. Lisa Blatt serves as the chair of Williams and Connolly Supreme Court and appellate practice. She's also argued a lot of cases in the Supreme Court. She began her career as an associate before joining the general counsel's office at the Department of Energy, followed by 13 years in the Office of Solicitor General, where I first got to meet Lisa when I was a very young and starstruck attorney in the Texas Solicitor General's office, which I vividly remember. She received her, I don't know if I mentioned where you went to law school, Paul, sorry. But Lisa went to the University of Texas Law School, where she received her J.D. summa cum laude, and she clerked for then-Judge the Honorable Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the D.C. Circuit. Next, Canon Shanmugam, who is a partner at Paul Weiss Rifkin Wharton and Garrison. He heads the Supreme Court and Appellate Litigation Practice. He's also the managing partner of the Washington office. You, too, have argued many cases in the Supreme Court. Previously, however, you served as assistant to the Solicitor General in the Department of Justice, and you went to Harvard and et cetera, and I've got lots of things to read here. And you also teach at Georgetown. Yes, Georgetown has a great faculty. And finally, but last but not least, the Honorable Seth P. Waxman, partner at WilmerHale, former Solicitor General of the United States from 1997 through January 2001. Again, this, I thought the biography was admirably restrained. And Seth told me he doesn't care what I mention. In terms of your bio, so I'll just stop there and leave it. Understated. I am deeply humbled and honored to be your moderator. And with that, I turn it over to Paul first. Take it away.
Well, thank you, Judge. I'm also delighted to be on this panel, and it's a special privilege to have you moderate it, since we two go back to representing some cases together, including our good friends at Hobby Lobby, or at least they're still my good friends. I don't know if you're a judge now, maybe you can't have any friends anymore. I don't know. But I was trying to think as to get ready for this panel, what I could possibly do to prepare for this panel, and then I thought, I think I've been living this. And so I'm just gonna sort of start it out by kind of saying that as the good judge pointed out, I am at a relatively small law firm. A year ago, I was on a panel in a different room here, and at that time, I was on a very large law firm with offices all around the globe, and grossing something like $6 billion or something last year. So I'm in very different circumstances than I was last year. And I don't want to talk too much about that, but I want to sort of put it in kind of the broader context that, at least in my view, the profession right now, and big law in particular, has a very serious problem. And the kind of two phenomena that the judge described, I don't think are sustainable in the long run. You can't really, if you just read Rule 1.2b, there's no exception for certain kinds of controversial cases. There's no exception for having cases that have sort of a conservative footprint rather than a liberal footprint. It talks about this being a real commitment that's supposed to cut across the profession, and it's supposed to guarantee us an adversarial system. And I would say, because of the bias that is in big law these days, we just don't have it. At least not at the highest level, not in the most important cases. And, don't take my word for it. Just, look at the numbers. I was doing a little informal research on my way in here today, so it's a little bit loose, so, don't quote this necessarily, or you can verify it before you do. But I looked, for example, in the Dobbs case. Okay, the Dobbs case is a case everybody knows about. It's quite a controversial case. So I looked at, how many kind of AmLaw 100, AmLaw 200 firms filed briefs on the top side of that case, supporting the state, supporting either the overruling of Roe or Casey, or even a more measured sort of Chief Justice type position, but all those sort of light green briefs. Looked at all of them to see how many were filed by lawyers at large law firms, or as Justice Scalia once memorably said, lawyers in tall buildings. The answer is, zero. It's a round number, zero. I mean, the largest law firm I think that I saw in there was Balch and Bingham, if I have the name right, and a fine law firm. I have some friends there, but I don't think they cracked the AmLaw 50. Maybe it's both an illustration of sort of that boutiques may be part, but only part of the solution. The judge's old law firm, now Sharon Jaffe, filed three briefs on the top side. It was so hard to find kind of a law firm to file a brief on the top side that they actually filed three different briefs with three different counsel of record. It's not a super huge law firm, by the way, so the fact that they filed three briefs is impressive, but I think also indicative of the problem.
Yeah, when I was in practice, Paul, this problem didn't seem like a problem to me because it meant a lot more business for me.
Yeah, no, and then, like, you know, that's, I suppose, a view. No, it's a view. But I think it is a problem. Now, you could say, well, look, you know, it's abortion. That's like the third rail. You know, maybe all these big law firms just stayed away from it. But then the dark green briefs are filed a couple of months later. And by my count, there were 24 different sort of AmLaw 100-type firms, including Sess Firm, for example, just to pick one. But it's all the big names, Covington, Arnold & Porter, a lot of the Milbank, Tweed, you know, Money Center, Financial, New York, big firms. And, you know, even one or two of them filed actually two briefs. But I didn't double count, though. So I got to sort of 24 kind of like, you know, huge law firms on one side of the case. So 24-0. Now, and just as kind of another one, this one interested me too, because just, okay, you know, maybe abortion's just special for some reason, but West Virginia against EPA. There's a case where, as the result emerges, I don't know sort of any case that the regulatory community is more excited about than West Virginia, the EPA, and the major questions doctrine. So you'd think, like, in support of West Virginia and the side that procured this great decision that's going to help numerous regulated parties that are the bread and butter of a lot of kind of AmLaw 200 sort of firms, you'd think there'd be lots of support on the top side of that case for West Virginia. The number of large firms that filed on the top side of that case in support of West Virginia was, again, a round number and was, again, zero. Less briefs total filed in this case, but on the bottom side, there were four briefs filed by major law firms, including Sess Law Firm and including by Lisa. Now, in fairness, like, Lisa's brief was on behalf of Apple. And, you know, obviously part of the phenomenon here we can talk about is that the big law firms are becoming increasingly woke because some of their clients are becoming increasingly woke. And it's hard to say no to, you know, good work in the Supreme Court from the Apple Inks of the world. So I'm not begrudging anyone. I'm just trying to point out that we have a problem here. And the reason I think we have a problem here is because I think the adversarial system depends on having the best possible representation from sort of both sides of the V. I don't think by any stretch, indeed, I'm banking my business model on it, that the AmLaw 200 does not have a monopoly on the best legal talent. But there are some things that an AmLaw 200 firm can do that other firms can't. And, you know, in some ways it's kind of a lucky thing, I suppose, that filing a Supreme Court brief doesn't take an army. But doing a trial in a controversial case, like a voting rights case or something like that, is an enormous undertaking. And that's pretty easy for a billion-dollar enterprise to put some money aside to do that pro bono. It is not particularly easy for a small law firm to do that if it consumes essentially every person in the law firm. And so, I mean, I'll end here. I don't want to monopolize it. I could talk about this all day because I think this is just a fundamental problem.
Not if you want us to actually sit here for the next hour.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. And I do want you to sit there, and I do want to hear from my co-panelists. But I will just wrap up by saying, I think the problem is pretty glaring. I think the solutions are much harder to find. I think this is, you know, very embedded in big law right now. But I just think if you look at those numbers, 24-0, 4-0, in a case that, if anything, should have been the other way around, I think we have a problem, and I think the profession as a whole needs to try to address it.
Thank you, Paul. You'll have some time in rebuttal. Let's see. Who are we? Who did we say was going next? Lisa, are you next? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll go next. Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. I'll go a little off topic just to try to keep it spicy. Let me just announce by saying I consider myself a liberal. And that's basically because I believe in climate change, that the earth is round, and that it's okay to make up constitutional rights if you can count to five.
J-
That's true.
I'm not sure that that is the hallmark of a liberal as opposed to a conservative.
But to be a liberal should mean that you believe in tolerance and the rights of others to express an opinion. I was either too naive or more likely too indifferent to expect the criticism I received for supporting nominations of extremely mainstream and obviously qualified conservative judges. The media and Twitter did not question the substance of my views, but rather that I was disqualified from speaking as a liberal because of my clients. Okay, to be fair, I defended the Redskins, big tobacco, pharma, companies accused of race discrimination, military general accused of sexual assault, and I've challenged the constitutionality of ICWA and tried to prevent half of Oklahoma from becoming an Indian reservation. But still.
How did that go, Lisa?
Okay, that was amazing. But still, I actually went to law school to serve clients who want to hire me, not to pass broad moral judgment on other lawyers or their clients. So here are some thoughts towards improving the situation. We must, as leaders and lawyers, reward, promote, and not shame ideological and political diversity. And we must start telling law students to not bring their politics to a firm. If you want to question the politics and businesses of firm clients, maybe you should not be at a large law firm collecting a paycheck from them. Also, just in case there are conservative law students in attendance, and I'm not sure that there are, but I think you should try to be patient with your liberal colleagues, who can be infuriating in their sense of moral superiority and judgment. Some of them will mature. I like to think that I did. And even if they don't, try to extend an olive branch anyway by finding common ground. There are endless, safe, trigger-free spaces for liberals and conservatives. Everyone loves talking about their families, their children, and their pets. Note how all of these subjects involve love, not hate. The Office of Solicitor General must maintain diversity of viewpoints. Seth, Paul, and Greg Garr, and Ted Olson made a point of hiring and valuing assistants with opposing ideological views. And I saw that for 13 years, and it had an enormous effect on me. Hiring in general. Paul Clement, in particular, has always liked having diverse lawyers working with him in private practice. We need to do more of this so we don't shy conservatives from working at big firms. Teaching. Paul has asked me to teach with him. We show students every day or every week that it's okay to have a different perspective on the law or politics, and even how to dress. Moot courts. We should be more willing to moot cross ideologically. I have loved mooting Paul's NRA cases and cases for Alliance Defending Freedom, and Sarah Harris of my firm, I've encouraged her, and she will moot the other side too, and I think it's a great thing to do.
Thank you. Who's next? Cannon.
Well, thank you all for being here bright and early on a Saturday morning, and it's always a great pleasure to speak to the Lawyers Convention. I'll try to be brief. I think that there is going to be agreement on this panel about the basic principles, which at a high level are the principles that Paul and Lisa articulated so well, that the adversarial system really depends on having the best possible representation on both sides, that lawyers should not shy away from representing unpopular clients, and that lawyers should not be shamed for doing so, and that lawyers should not somehow be identified with the views or the positions of their clients. Those principles are embedded in the American legal system. As Judge Duncan pointed out, they go back to John Adams's representation in connection with the Boston Massacre, and I think those principles cannot reasonably be questioned. At the same time, we're here doing a panel on this subject, and I think we should all wonder, why are we here at this time talking about this issue? Why is this issue so much in the news, most recently with Paul's departure from Kirkland and Ellis? And I have just a couple of thoughts about this, and I will offer these observations from the perspective of someone who, at least in private practice, has only practiced in the Am Law 200 law firms, first as an associate at Kirkland & Ellis, and then after my time in the Solicitor General's office at now Lisa's firm, Williams & Connolly, and now most recently at Paul Weiss. And I guess I sort of have three questions and three observations. So the first question, are there fewer conservatives now in big law than there used to be? It feels as if the answer to that question is yes. That having been said, I'm not sure that big law was ever all that conservative. You know, Paul and I, when we were both initially at Kirkland & Ellis, were there around the time that Ken Starr was leading the appellate practice. Ken, of course, who recently passed away, was a Republican Solicitor General, was obviously a very prominent conservative, particularly after he left and then came back from the independent counsel investigation. And yet, at least based on my experience, and this was now 20 years ago, I wouldn't actually say that Kirkland was a particularly conservative law firm. I remember that the Legal Times, back when there was a Legal Times, an actual newspaper covering the legal industry, wrote a story about how Kirkland's partners gave far more money to Hillary Clinton when she ran for the Senate in New York than for her Republican opponent. I think it was, and in some sense still is true, that when large law firms are described as conservative, it's simply because they have a few prominent conservative partners. I think that a more accurate way of thinking about things nowadays is that there are two types of law firms, liberal and more liberal, in terms of the makeup of the lawyers who work there. And I would just add one other thought on this subject, which is that I think if you look at the leadership of big law firms, and in particular, if you look at the leadership of, you know, what I would describe as the 8 or 10 perhaps most elite law firms, there are very, very few conservatives in that leadership. I think when I left Williams & Connolly, there were no conservatives on the committee that ran the law firm. When I sort of think about those 8 or 10 law firms, I can think of maybe one of those firms who has a conservative running it. I'm obviously the managing partner of our DC office, and I'm one of a very, very small number of conservatives in leadership at the law firm. And I think that that has meaningful implications because a lot of the decisions about what law firms do are made by the people in leadership. So the second question, I think, is it harder to take conservative positions, particularly as a pro bono matter, at large law firms? And I think that the answer to that question is also yes. You know, as Paul said, I think there was a time when abortion was viewed as sort of the third rail issue on which law firms either wouldn't take a position at all or would only take a position on the pro-abortion side. It feels as if the list of issues that are viewed as controversial is growing. And what's most interesting about that is that it is increasingly encompassing not just pro bono matters, but the types of ordinary meat and potatoes corporate representations that lawyers at big law firms, one might expect, would naturally take on. And I think that there are a lot of different reasons for this. I think that lawyers in a younger generation, and we all define a younger generation as people who are younger than we are, so I'll say lawyers coming out of law school now, I think don't share the same commitment to the basic principles that we've been talking about. And we can talk over the course of the next hour about, you know, the extent to which law schools are responsible for that. But I think that often at large law firms, it's the younger lawyers who raise issues about many of these representations, including, as I say, the sort of heartland types of representations that large law firms typically take on, like representations of energy companies or the financial services industry. And I think, quite frankly, to some extent, I think that the sort of social media age in which we live has something to do with that, because I think nowadays, you know, if you go on Twitter or Mastodon or whatever the preferred service is today, you'll see a lot of that sort of very toxic rhetoric about lawyer representations in virtually every single case. You know, three of my most recent Supreme Court arguments were for ExxonMobil, Goldman Sachs, and for Lisa's former client, the state of Oklahoma. In all of those cases, I was certainly on the receiving end of some Twitter vitriol. I've basically had my wife take on responsibility for reading the mean tweets because I don't read them anymore. She delights in reading them aloud to me. with remarkable relish, actually. And I think that there is this sort of environment in which if you don't agree with the position that a lawyer is advocating, it's seemingly okay to go after the lawyer for taking on the representation. It's not just that the legal position is viewed as incorrect, it's that the lawyer is somehow acting improperly by having the temerity to advance a legal position with which you disagree. And I think that that's just fundamentally antithetical to the principles we're talking about today. But maybe to disagree slightly with Paul, just so that we can actually have a dialogue rather than consensus, I think the third issue here is, you know, is it possible to be a conservative, and yes, to take conservative positions at a big law firm? And I think that the answer to that question is still yes. In some respects, it's more challenging. I think often in large law firms, conservatives have to navigate the politics of the institution in order to be able to take on those representations. And yes, there are certain issues that are very difficult in this environment to handle. And in part, that's often because law firms already have pre-existing commitments on those issues, such as on the issue of abortion. But I do think it's possible to be a conservative at a large law firm and to flourish as a conservative at a large law firm. And I do think it would be an unfortunate development if we as conservatives felt that we had to abandon large law firms, if we thought that the only option was to join thriving boutiques like Paul's in order to be able to practice comfortably as conservatives. I think that the reality is that there are enormous benefits from practicing at a large law firm, not just the economic benefits given the incredible success that those law firms have had, but also just the benefits from being able to work on the biggest and most important matters, which for a variety of reasons tend to gravitate to those large law firms, and to tap into the incredible networks that those large law firms have on all sides of the political spectrum. And so I think it would be quite sad if we had the sort of assortative mating in big law that we sort of see in other aspects of American life right now with the growing polarization of the two political parties. Again, I do think it's possible to be a conservative at a large law firm and to thrive, but there's no question that the atmosphere and the environment has become more difficult.
Thank you, Cannon. Over to you, Seth.
Sure. First of all, I want to thank Dean, who always has been very gracious over the, it seems like 40 years, and I guess I'm old enough to claim 40 years of participation in Federalist Society programs, but for the constant invitation to come speak on panels like this. In today's polarized world, I think there's no doubt that I am characterized as a liberal. I recall when I was in the Justice Department working for Janet Reno, and I got a telephone call from President Clinton asking me if I would like to be nominated to be Solicitor General. My first reaction was like, who is this really? I thought it was Dave Margolis or something like that. And then basically thought that I needed to say, look, I would love to do it, but you know that I didn't contribute to your campaign and I've spent most of my adult life as a registered independent. His reaction was, I know, that's what I really love about this. I also listened to the judge's recitation of the kinds of things, the kinds of representations that you, quote, shouldn't be doing. And, you know, I have in the list, Gitmo detainees, I certainly represented Gitmo detainees. Oil companies, I currently represent two oil companies. I began law practice as right out of a district court clerkship and was quite insistent that I was going to spend 25% of my time on pro bono matters, defined as things that I thought were really important. And I went and told the managing partner of the law firm that I wanted to represent death row inmates. His reaction was, these are horrible people. They deserve the punishment that they get. Why do you want to do this? And I'm like, I reached back and said, this is going to be a great way to learn how to try cases, right? These people don't have any other lawyers. I'm going to have the experience of, like, and he was like, yeah, we love that. But I, you know, I've spent 40-something years representing people on death row, none of whom I want to befriend. But it's been one of the many ways that I've tried to craft my pro bono practice, at least, to do my part to the English translation of the Hebrew importation is to repair the world, to try and craft a pro bono practice to help make society a little bit better from my own lights. Now, I will say that I also represented the NCAA in the antitrust litigation that was decided adversely in the Supreme Court. And at the time, I remember I was speaking to a law school class at Cornell that Judge Wesley runs. And, you know, I basically said, I've represented death row inmates my whole life, you know, and they are despised people and I've been criticized for it. But honestly, I don't think I've ever represented a more despised client than the NCAA. you know, I have had almost a professional lifetime of representing Monsanto, both when it was a chemical company and a biological engineering company. And my daughter, who is has never had any doubts about her left-leaning political affiliations, made a point for many years when she was still in town of coming not only to listen to the arguments, but to sit on the other side of the courtroom as if there was sort of a bride and groom. So I do want to say that there is no doubt that the adversarial legal system is incredible. It is an incredible engine for determining the truth. It's, you know, maybe this just reflects the fact that I was born, bred, and have led my life practicing in an adversarial system rather than the inquisitorial system that is so common in many other parts of the world. I think that it is incumbent upon lawyers for sure, when they feel that it's important and that they can be effective advocates, to represent exceptionally unpopular clients and causes. I think the legal profession does a very good job at it. I don't know what you define as popular or unpopular, I suppose, depends on what your particular view of an issue is. I just, I just finished 8 years of litigation representing Harvard University and defending its holistic admissions program with a 5 hour and 10 minute oral argument in the Supreme Court with only 5 minutes for a bathroom break. I am not on social media. I don't have a Twitter account or whatever the other social media platforms are. But I can tell you that within 48 hours of the oral argument, I had probably, 20 telephone messages and an equal number of emails, including, quite explicit threats of violence, which I think is a reflection of the kind of deterioration and atomization and radicalization of our society generally. Not necessarily, none of these were from lawyers. They're from.
I assume most of them were from people associated with Yale.
There were most of them were from people who believed that I was who challenged me as being a racist that should be exterminated. P.S. We know where you live. So you know, there's the kind of invective that lawyers who are involved in cases that controversial, you know, that evoke strong differences of opinions is just an occupational hazard. When I was Solicitor General, I similarly got similar threats. I have on my wall in my office framed a letter that I got that says, "Dear Solicitor General, moron, close paren." I want to confront the what I think may be a conflation in Paul's comments between the importance of our system in seeing that each side of a dispute, whether it's a dispute between two individuals, between two causes, you know, is adequately represented so that the adversary system is served, and a comment about where big law is or isn't. I missed because the Harvard argument went not an hour and a half, but 5.5 hours, I actually missed the planning meeting for this program. And therefore, in the notes, there was an explication of what Paul was going to say and what Lisa was going to say and, you know, what Cannon was going to say. And in the end, there was just a thing saying, you know, Seth will say whatever he's going to say, presumably a defense of big law, which I find a little peculiar, because when I finished my clerkship, I declined to go to a big law firm. I joined a small boutique law firm called Miller Cassidy LaRocca and Lewin, which was formed and for the purpose of, and in fact, got all of its business by handling cases that the big law firms didn't want to handle for institutional reasons, which had therefore the most interesting and challenging clients and issues to represent. And it was an amazing, amazing place. And then when it disappeared while I was in government, and when I came out, it was a tough choice to decide what to do, but I joined Wilmer Cutler and Pickering. And I remember I was, you know, quite interested in the law firm's pro bono practice. I made clear that I wanted to have an avid pro bono practice, and I went in for a series of interviews, and I remember sitting down with Boyden Gray, who was then one of the senior partners at the law firm and who I knew, and I said, Boyden, you know, I've talked to people, you know, here about the firm's approach to pro bono, but I really value our time because I think I can probably get some insights into the firm's pro malum practice. And Boyden looked at me and says, we're counting on you to bring that to the law firm. I don't think that we are facing in any respect in this country a deficit in the ability of very talented, very motivated lawyers and law firms to represent oil companies, gun manufacturers, tobacco companies, whatever it is that keeps Paul from running from one law firm to another. If it is, I can't remember the numbers, but I think Paul's two examples were 24-0 and 4-0. I think it's probably worth noting that the zeros in both of those cases won decisively in the Supreme Court. So the notion that there is some effect on the vitality and vigor of the adversarial system, I think, doesn't follow from whatever one thinks about a big law firm. I can't speak about big law firms really beyond the only big law firm that I've ever joined, which was originally Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, which was a, quote, big law firm with 300 lawyers, but then completely, without any support from me, became a humongous law firm of 960 lawyers. I spend a significant part of my time editing, consulting with, and mooting on cases that represent political, not political views, but constitutional views, jurisprudential views I don't agree with. And my conservative partners do the same for me. And I certainly feel like lawyers, whether they're in a big law firm or not, are part of a profession that should, in fact, do everything they can to raise, to elevate the tone of the profession, including, you know, mooting people whose if you were a judge, you wouldn't agree with them on, you know, et cetera, et cetera. if there is, and there probably it probably is true, I think, you know, Wilmer Hale has more self-identified liberal partners than conservative partners. But I think as an institution, we, you know, as a consequence, probably value conservative partners more than, you know, the 99th liberal partner. And I think there may be a process of self-selection going on in deciding what you want to, you know, whether you want to join a big law firm or not. I, you know, it's easy to think at a superficial level of law firms that appear to be more conservative on balance than other law firms. I have never really wanted to work at a law firm that carried that appellation one way or the other. I feel like lawyers ought to be able to work in an environment where they can take the cases they want to take, assuming there's no ethical conflict, and be supported by their colleagues. You know, one of the, when I joined Miller Cassidy, one of the, which was formed by, you know, Jack Miller and John Cassidy, who came out of the Kennedy administration. Jack was the head of the criminal division. One of the firm's clients was Richard Nixon. We represented Richard Nixon from the day he resigned. And, you know, I came in as a young associate and was asked to work on, you know, one of the Nixon cases. And, you know, I had this, you know, crisis of conscience. I remember being in college and railing against Richard Nixon and the war in Vietnam, and, you know, he ought to be napalmed and all the kinds of stupid things that young people sometimes say when they're caught up in the war, they're in college and they're caught up in the war in Vietnam. But I decided, look, I can be an effective I can effectively represent Richard Nixon. Jack Miller is a, you know, lifelong Democrat. He's doing it. And I did, and we won. On the other hand, I was asked at the time, a couple of years later, by Phyllis Schlafly, who wanted to institute a lawsuit challenging the law that permitted, you know, the drafting of women and women serving in the military, and basically said to her, you know what, I get the point. I see the argument. I cannot be an effective advocate for that position. I can't. And, you know, notwithstanding what, whatever it is, Rule 1.2b says, there are other, you know, rules that basically say that a lawyer's representation has to be tempered by personal interests of the lawyer or instances in which the lawyer reasonably believes that the lawyer cannot provide competent or the most effective representation. I like to think that the legal profession is still an exception to what the phenomenon that I think Cannon reflected, which is essentially a near disintegration of our civil society with respect to the discussion of political and controversial issues, where people have their own bespoke news, their own bespoke group of people that they speak to. I feel like the legal profession has succumbed to this less than others. And I also think that the legal profession should make it a priority to continue to teach by example how one engages in an adversarial system as professionals and human beings. And I think we can do that, but I think the challenge in our country is unspeakably difficult.
Thank you, Seth. Well said.
So short introduction, but no red light.
We've had a lot of wonderful ideas thrown around, and I know that the panel would like to say a few more words in response to some things that were said, and or we want to hear from the audience. So I'll give the panelists a little time, not so much for rebuttal or to say whatever else you'd like to say.
I'll take rebuttal.
Okay, rebuttal, Paul.
So I certainly agree with Seth that the issue isn't, at this stage anyways, that one side can't get able representation. But I do think it's a mistake to say that, and I think it has to be conceded, that one side on many of these disputes, and as Cannon points out, the number is increasing, can only get able representation from large law firms from one side of the case. And I mean, it's, you know, I applaud Seth for representing Harvard. I'm horrified by the remarks, not that you got, not surprised, but horrified by them. I'll just say as a personal anecdote, I've represented a few unpopular clients. The worst kind of hate mail I've ever gotten was when I represented the NFL against Tom Brady. I mean, Patriots fans are nasty. But the one thing that sort of kind of made that situation different is that, like, in my experience, you get the hate mail and you almost never get sort of the attaboys back. It's people are much more motivated about what they're against than what they're for. But when I represented the NFL in the Brady case, I actually got many nice notes from Jets fans. So that was an unusual dynamic. But no, I'm horrified by those comments, not surprised by them. But I also think I don't think I'm breaking ground by saying it's unthinkable that with the possible exception of Jones Day, that you could represent the other side of the Harvard case at a big law firm right now. I mean, you just couldn't. And it's a one-way street on increasingly a large number of controversial issues. And I just don't see how that can possibly be good for the profession. And it's worse than that. I think it ultimately sort of risks the whole notion that what this is a profession. I think there's actually a close connection between Rule 1.2b and this notion that the lawyer isn't the client and lawyers are supposed to represent unpopular clients. And the whole reason you get to keep client confidence is privilege. The whole idea that you sort of behave with a different set of norms and rules, that's all because it's a profession. And, you know, the big law firms, I mean, there's kind of two ways to think about what's going on at big law firms. Either they're just all kind of becoming woke because as the big corporations go woke, it sort of unleashes the relatively liberal leadership of the firm to kind of sort of follow their clients. That's one explanation. I mean, you know, the other explanation, and I think there's a little bit of truth to both, but the other explanation is that lawyers have just decided that they want to make as much money as their clients at these big law firms. And so this idea of a profession and the thought of losing half your clients is just unthinkable. And I think it's the more transactional lawyers you have at a firm, I think the bigger the problem is. You know, the interesting thing about transactional lawyers is they tend to think, well, transactionally. And so if, you know, dropping an ongoing representation for one client means you're going to get three new ones, let's see, three's bigger than one, let's do it. But the problem is if law firms start just behaving like businesses, and I think that's the way many of the largest law firms are behaving, then their claim to the special privileges of being a profession, I don't think are going to be terribly credible. And if you only take popular clients, then you sort of are your clients and, you know, why should you be able to shield their information and all that sort of thing. So I think there's a real kind of problem here. And look, I don't disagree with Cannon that it's possible to be a conservative at a big law firm, but it's not possible to be a conservative at the big law firm the way it is possible to be a big liberal. I mean, you can be a liberal at a big law firm and you don't have to basically say, all right, that means that there's like six issues that I have to sort of stay away from. That are, you know, maybe the issues that define why I'm a conservative instead of a liberal. And if you're a conservative, it varies from firm to firm, but I think at most of the big law firms right now, with the exception of Jones Day, I mean, you just basically say, like, all right, you know, abortion, forget it. Race, forget it. Guns, forget it. And, you know, I mean, if that's what, you know, most of the American public care about, it's a pretty big sacrifice. And, you know, and I think it's you know, if it's just a sacrifice, it's a sacrifice. But I think it's a sacrifice that's fundamentally antithetical to what the practice and the profession is supposed to be about. So I agree with Seth that law practice is better than the rest of the country. But I think it should. We should try to do our best to make it even better. And I think the way to do that is to just remind people that what we're on about is very different. It's not just a business. And the reason we represent unpopular people is because it's absolutely vital. And it's not just vital that they get some representation. It really, I think, is critical to the whole system that there be kind of equal availability of the very best, the very most well-heeled sort of resources for both sides. That's how we're going to get the best results in our system.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, I just see this at a more sort of micro level. I came from Arnold Porter, and I had brought some conservatives were working with me, and I'll never forget this email celebrating some very anti-death penalty case, like some, you know, massive rapist, murder, whatever, was going to, you know, not get the death penalty. And it was like, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And this conservative was like, what is this crap? And I complained and said, you know, there might have been people who disagreed with that decision. Like, it might have been tragic. Like, there's just two sides. And the head of the firm said, did you look at the name on the door? You know, we're Gideon, we're a death penalty firm, so get over it. And I was like, okay, that's that. You know, I'm not going to complain. But I appreciated the honesty of, like, we're anti-death penalty, and you don't like it, shut up. And I don't like the death penalty. I was trying to stand up for a conservative who felt alienated. The problem with law firms, and, you know, I care the most about young people, is the sense of shame and humiliation they feel both ways. Liberals feel every time a conflict memo comes around about something that they don't like, whether we're anti-civil rights or, you know, seen as anti-gay rights, they feel alienated and unheard and dismissed and unwanted. And every time a conservative is told, you know, something about religious liberty, they're told that they're evil and unwanted. And this is just nuts. Like, who's against religious liberty? Seriously. This is crazy. So our firm is actually doing a lot of religious liberty work, which is great. But this should not be something we should be arguing about, and nor the Second Amendment. I really don't get it. I just feel like, you know, law firms should be about making money, and at the same time, you should tell people to check their politics, including clients, check their politics somewhere else. We're here to win a case, keep you out of jail, you know, crush a plaintiff or, you know, crush a corporation. What does it matter?
Or a defendant.
But the key, at least for somebody who cares about the young people, is making sure that they feel they have a way to grow professionally and be able to file things like amicus briefs. And I do think law firms should try to just let everybody speak their own voice and just not judge people. And it gets harder. Again, I just could care less about this stuff and feel like, why not just leave people alone? But I'm very much in the minority these days.
Thank you, Lisa. Jenna.
Yeah, I guess I just have a couple of thoughts picking up on things that my fellow panelists have said. You know, the first is that, you know, it is really sort of horrifying to imagine that a lawyer like Seth could get actual threats for taking on a representation that is, you know, consistent with the finest traditions of the profession. And, you know, I make light of the sort of Twitter vitriol, but I'll tell you, I've probably never been madder in private practice than I was when, after handling one particularly high-profile representation, I think we had just filed a cert petition in the Supreme Court, there were folks on Twitter saying, you know, we need to really name and shame not Cannon, who was the counsel of record, but all of the associates who worked on this brief. And I just thought, you know, what have we sort of come to where associates who are doing what they are assigned to do are being swept up in this effort to cast shame on lawyers who take on representations. So, you know, this is a very real problem, and I think in some sense it reflects just the broader toxicity of our public discourse at a time when public officials and others are also under unprecedented threats, including members, of course, of the Supreme Court. I think the second thing I would say is that, you know, one thing that gives me heart is that there are, you know, liberals like Seth and Lisa, though I still have hope for her, who are really committed to these sort of basic principles. And I think it's very important for us as conservatives not to tar all liberals as sort of having this reductive view that law is just politics by another means. I'm very proud, although I practice at a law firm that is predominantly liberal, to practice with many, many lawyers who I think share the commitment that Seth so eloquently laid out to, you know, taking on representations even when they're unpopular, taking on representations even when, you know, my partners might prefer to vote for the other side. And so, you know, I think that in many ways, the issues that we're discussing today cut across political labels. And then the last thing I would say is just to pick up on something that Paul observed. You know, there have been a lot of sort of significant changes both in the corporate world and in the law firm world since I started practicing more than 20 years ago. There's no doubt that the corporate world has gotten more liberal or woke, if you prefer, and that definitely has an impact on large law firms who, after all, as Lisa put it perhaps somewhat more trenchantly than I would, you know, basically exist to represent corporate interests, to represent well-off individuals. And the views of our clients inevitably have an effect on the decisions that we make as law firms about what clients to take on. And as Paul rightly pointed out, one of the reasons why law firms like his former law firm, like my law firm, are so economically successful is because of the non-litigation work they do, the work that they do on the transactional side. And there's no doubt that law firms view the practice of law, big law firms view the practice of law more as a business and perhaps less as a profession than they used to. And that is a large part of this, because when you talk about the issues that Paul listed, those are typically the sorts of issues that large law firms would do on a pro bono basis. Not always, but typically. And so if you have law firms that are making, as was true of Paul's former law firm, I think something like $7 million plus a year per partner, the first question that the leadership of those law firms is inevitably going to ask is some version of, why should we do this? What's in this for us to take on this representation? And there can be no doubt that that is a broader dynamic that is affecting the way that large law firms go about making these decisions. And so if a large law firm can say, our corporate client base will be happy if we take on this side of a representation, then sure, it's more likely that a large law firm is going to do so. And I think that's sort of an underreported aspect of this whole debate, is that the way that law firms have changed is impacting, I think, the willingness of law firms to take on certain representations, and in particular representations on certain sides of the V.
Thank you, Cannon. Seth, did you have anything
I feel like
else?
I've already used up all of my speaking time.
Well, if you have anything else you'd like to add, please.
I just, you know, would say that, you know, my perspective, I am a partner at a large law firm, which has more than 50% of the lawyers are litigators. We don't have a huge, the kind of huge corporate practice, for example, that Kirkland has. And maybe as a consequence, I don't know, because this is my only experience with a large law firm, we are not sort of blackballing representations. Of course, it's a business. I mean, you know, I don't know that we're in the $6 billion range or that all the partners are making seven. Well, I do know that all the partners are not making $7 million. But, you know, it's a business. It should be run as a business. If you don't, and I feel like in certain respects it constrains me. I get lots of calls from people or companies that would like me to represent them. And it turns out that I can't, not because I'm being politically blackballed because they don't think I should be representing an oil company, but because we have a conflict. You know, when you have a law firm of 1,000 lawyers, it turns out there are a lot of legal positions you can't take anymore. And it has led me many, many, many times to think, you know, I should go back to where I started, which is at a small law firm, which is just, they're just, these things just don't come up.
We have a place for you if you ever.
and particularly, Paul, I love the fact that in that single hire, you could transform the ideological diversity of your new
We're already more diverse than you think, but it would definitely help in that department.
I mean, Paul,
I would love it. I would love it. So just,
yeah. Well, Paul,
it is a serious offer.
Paul,
you know, I gotta check with Aaron, but I think she'll be okay with it. So the offer.
You got $7 million.
Paul will recall how earnestly and insistently I tried to get him to come join me at Wilmer when he was leaving the government. And, you know, Paul's reaction was like, what sense does this make? Which was exactly the same conversation I had with John Roberts when he tried to recruit me to join him at Hogan at Hartson. And I gave the same response, was this is just going to be great. We read the Constitution, we see things differently, we like each other, we're going to elevate each other's games. Are we going to be competing for business? Yes, but let's compete for business in the same law firm. Like, why not put together a really, you know, a really great, diverse, multi-perspective place? Maybe large law firms in general aren't the easiest platforms to do that. That's just one of the consequences. It's a reason why I didn't join a large law firm when I came out of law school. It's a compromise you make. But yes, law firms are businesses, and I don't want to get into a discussion about whether law firms or corporations are woke, because unlike perhaps everybody else in this room, I don't actually know what that term means other than as a form of derogation. But when I joined my little boutique law firm right out of a clerkship, we had one rule and one rule only, which is we are not going to represent anybody in organized crime. And that's because Jack Miller was the head of the criminal division when they went after Jimmy Hoffa. And, you know, he founded the law firm, and this was really important to him, and we just didn't do that. When I joined Wilmer, the rule was we are not going to represent any tobacco companies because, you know, Lloyd Cutler or John Pickering or something, I don't know, somebody had some experience and we'd done litigation about this. And I'm like, okay, fine, you know, I don't feel like I'm driven to represent tobacco companies. If I were, I would have joined a different law firm. But, you know, law firms are businesses, even small law firms are businesses. They just have different constraints on them. And I think when the day comes when that fact constitutes a threat to the vigor of our adversary system, then we really need to take action, either as a profession or, you know, get our legislative body, which so easily passes legislation, bipartisan legislation these days, to legislate and make sure that the adversary system has the support that it needs in order to shore it up.
Thank you, Seth. Let's go to questions. I see people lined up. If you would please just announce yourself briefly and make your question in the form of a question. That's always helpful.
Okay. Mike Doherty here with the Justice Society. My question's about who should take the lead in the profession of lawyers attacking other lawyers, and as far as what cases they have, and specifically lawyers that have been participating in election law and Trump defense, because there have been groups that have popped up that spend their full time then intimidating, bar complaining, coordinated, you know, canceling out of these lawyers, whether it be Cleta Mitchell, Headley Foley, or the litany of others that aren't as well known. And is that okay suddenly? Who's defending that? Who is the profession supposed to stand up and say, stop?
Okay. Anybody want to take that? Lawyers I'll take attacking
it.
Other
I mean,
lawyers.
I... I did a lot of election protection work in connection with the 2020 presidential election. I represented the Democratic National Committee in most of the 60-something cases that were filed, beginning just before Election Day and ending sometime after Inauguration Day. I don't remember attacking any of the lawyers who were doing it, but I will say this without mentioning particular names. Lawyers are entitled to, you know, present a vigorous argument based on
based on facts that are at least arguably proven. They are not entitled, and in fact, they are precluded by their professional obligations from making an argument, from making legal arguments and representations about facts that simply not only cannot be proven, but are demonstrably incorrect. And the criticism of some lawyers in that litigation as making factual representations to courts that are manifestly false, I think deserve criticism from the bar. Now that said, you know, I've made...
So it's okay for Project 65 to organize staffs to do bar complaints en masse, that's okay?
I'm sorry, I can't, well, my point is this, I have spent my entire career in part litigating cases that are politically and ideologically very divisive. I have never, until that spate of election litigation, ever had the experience in which I actually heard a lawyer stand up and say things that were so utterly manifestly untrue. I've had no problem whatsoever. And I think it's inappropriate to criticize lawyers for taking legal positions that you strongly disagree with. And I've never had a problem getting along on a professional basis with lawyers who are on the opposite side of me on voting rights issues, race issues, free exercise, establishment clause issues. Everything is completely professional in the way that you would hope it would operate. All I'm saying is that the fact that you are a lawyer doesn't give you an automatic free pass from criticism by other lawyers. If the criticism is you have gone beyond any conceivable scope of acceptable representation and representations to the court, that's my point.
Would anyone else like to take that up, or shall we move on? Okay, thank you. Why don't we go over here? Go ahead.
Francis Hoare, I'm a public law and election law barrister in London. Last year, Dinah Rose KC, who is a very prominent liberal barrister in London, was criticised heavily for representing a Caribbean country in an appeal to the Privy Council, which still decides some issues about its constitutional change and about same-sex marriage. And she was defending a position that was very unpopular. The reason she was able to answer that criticism, defend her and defend the right of all parties to be represented, is because we have a very, very strict rule. It sounds like it's a lot stricter than Rule 1.2b that you were talking about, if I've got that right, which is that unless you have a professional conflict, that is to say, not a conflict with your personal views or your principles or your company's views, unless you have a professional conflict, or you're not offered reasonable representation, or it isn't your area of law, you have to take every case. It's the cab rank principle. You are like a taxi. Is it the case, and this is my question, apologies for the introduction, is it the case that states and the federal system in this country would benefit from having that system, which is also used to your northern neighbours, I think, have it. Australia and other common law countries have it too. And would that be an answer to the serious problems that have been discussed so eloquently today?
Thank you. Anyone want to take that?
I mean, it seems to me that as long as the clients are required to pay 100% of your legal fees promptly, that would be a great innovation.
And I will say, I mean, I do think it would be a solution, but it's a pretty radical solution. I mean, it's a solution, and I wonder whether... I'm a great admirer of the British system and the barristers in particular, and I think that I wonder if you can really have the cab rank principle without the division between the solicitors and the barristers. But I will say, in another life, I wish I could be a barrister. I mean, I think that's it's a wonderful system, and I do think that the cab rank principle is very tightly tethered to the idea that you have somebody else that's going out and sort of kind of getting the business for you, and then sort of presenting you with these cases to argue. To me, it sounds like a little slice of heaven.
Well, the
the other thing that is, I mean, I don't think that the British system can be translated, because the distinction between solicitors and barristers is just difficult for me to get my mind around. But the practice in the British system of having chambers in which you have members of the chambers, like on one day I'm prosecuting and Cannon is defending, and the next day Cannon is prosecuting and I'm defending, seems like a dream come true. It really does. And I think it would instantiate what's going on now. It would require a wholesale revamping of the ethics rules in the United States. I mean, the notion that within a same law firm, you could both have lawyers who are both prosecuting one side of a legal issue and defending the other side of a legal issue is the very definition of non-professional behavior. So maybe we should all sign on to, you know, some barrister's chambers, but we can't do it in our current legal system, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Question.
Hi, my name is David Latt, and I write a newsletter on Substack called Original Jurisdiction. I think anyone who's read the newsletter or heard my podcast interview with Paul, for example, knows how I feel about these issues. I'm not a fan of wokeness, and I do think that the legal profession is getting to a troubling place on these issues. But let me play devil's advocate with two questions. One, and this picks up on the gentleman's question from across the room, we value free association. And I think, as Seth pointed out, many times the side turned down by big law does very well. Why is it a problem if we have diversity within the overall legal marketplace? Why is it a problem not to have diversity within a big law firm? So, for example, as long as somebody can go to a Clement Murphy or a Kaplan Hecker or a Kirkland & Ellis or a Jones Day, why is that not a good thing from a free association perspective and a free market perspective? Law firms should be able to define themselves, as Lisa was saying, as the anti-death penalty firm. Why is that not a value for conservatives or libertarians? Again, I'm playing devil's advocate. But a second point is, I think a lot of the issues here are coming from the talent and concerns about alienating talent, liberal law students who are needed to work on, say, M&A matters. So let me ask, my second question is, the world of big law is a lot more diverse than it used to be. And as a person of color and a gay man, I think this is great. What would you say to people who say, it is troubling when you take on these representations on the pro-life side or against LGBT rights because you are inflicting harm on me as an associate and your workplace is unwelcoming and threatening to me? So how would you respond to this harm principle if it's raised by talent or potential recruits? So those are my two questions.
Thank you, David. So we have two questions. Let a thousand flowers bloom and have the liberal law firm, have the conservative law firm. It's all, let's have free association. And then what about the associates who feel alienated by certain representations? Anyway.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, I can just take the alienation one. I mean, it's just the alienation is on both sides. And I think the problem with liberals is they don't understand the alienation conservatives feel. And it's almost because theirs is invalid and immoral and just not superior. And that's just bizarre that you could have that kind of judgment. I mean, I think conservative values are a little bizarre and immoral, but well, so what? I mean, you should just, but I do think it's hard to explain to a person who feels victimized that their victimization is because of some injustice, structural, whatever, in society, and a conservative sense of injustice and alienation is just based on viewpoint. And I don't think that's fair, because the alienation and the feelings of being unwanted are the same. And so there is a situation where young people just feel very, on all sides, very, there's just abundant. I mean, I think part of it is just young people feel free to whine a lot. But
I mean, I'll add 2 points. I'm not going to comment on that last one. But, David, I don't think that this is a matter of, like, the legal system collapsing or anything like that, precisely for the reason that, was pointed out earlier, which is that in many of these cases, the side that has fewer big law firms on it nevertheless miraculously seems to prevail. And there are lots of great lawyers in not just smaller law firms, but in public interest firms and groups that are handling these matters. My concern is the much narrower one that I stated at the outset, which is that I do think it would be really unfortunate, if not tragic, if conservatives didn't feel welcome at large law firms because of all the benefits of being at large law firms. And I guess I have a little bit of a selfish viewpoint in that regard. As a managing partner, but also as the head of my practice, like all of these folks, you know, I just want the most talented people to join my practice. And quite frankly, although, you know, many of my all-time favorite former associates or conservatives, you know, it really just doesn't matter. I want to make sure that we're getting the most talented people in the doors of our law firm and our office. One of the things that I'm frankly proudest of is that our summer associate classes are very ideologically diverse, that we have not been prey in the Paul Weiss Washington office to the sort of ideological sorting that you see at other law firms. I see quite a few of our former and future summer associates here who I paid to be in the audience this morning. Your checks from the firm will be coming, but in all seriousness, like, we are in the talent business. And so part of the reason I have concern about this is I wanna make sure that, you know, 50% of the talent doesn't opt out of big law because of these concerns.
Thank you.
I got my chance to answer most of David's questions in the podcast, but I can't resist the temptation to say two things. One is, I think the answer to both of your questions is really the same, which is I think it's incumbent on people to really reaffirm what is distinct about being a lawyer and to confront them with 1.2b and the principle that, you know, you don't have to love all our clients, but you do have to sort of get over the fact that you don't love all our clients. That's what it means to be a lawyer. And because that's what it means to be a lawyer, it's great if there are really good big conservative law firms or moderate leaning conservative and really big conservative law firms that lean liberal and small ones and boutiques and lots of choices for clients. But it's not good if all the biggest, most sort of profitable law firms with the capability to do certain kinds of cases in a distinct way have a distinct political view. That's a sign that something's wrong, that we haven't reminded people of this. But to say one thing in defense of big law firms, the concern about the talent is real, and they're not getting any help from the colleges and the law schools. I was on a panel yesterday about, you know, that was discussing a 1967 statement of academic freedom from the University of Chicago called the Calvin Report. It's a great read. It's only 2 pages long, so it's a quick read. But one of the things they said at the University of Chicago in 1967 in the height of the Vietnam War is that a university is supposed to be upsetting. It is supposed to confront you with ideas that you disagree with. You are supposed, that's how you learn, is to be upset. And, like, you know, where is that in our colleges and law schools? And so if the talent shows up after 7 years about, you know, people apologizing them for anything that might upset them, it's a pretty tough position for the law firms then to sort of deal with it and kind of re-educate at that point.
Thank you, Paul. Please go ahead.
Hello, this is Joe Cosby. I'm a practitioner in Washington, D.C. It strikes me that the world that that the panel is describing is a lot different than the world that Barry Weiss sees. It's almost as though there's a world out there, whether it's the younger people or the clients or whatever, that is really, really antagonistic, and the law firm world, which hasn't gotten to that point yet. So my question is, does that mean, how would you prepare proactively for the future? Do the law firms have to start concerning, or what do you think the profession needs to start considering preparing and taking certain positions in order to try and change the culture? Do you need to hunker down in order to survive? Or if you don't see the world quite that way, what do you think the future holds and how the profession ought to prepare for that?
Thank you. A question about possible solutions. Anyone want to venture a thought? What can firms do? What can they do?
I gave you like 7 answers. Yeah, you need to educate, you need to model, you need to, it's like parenting. You got to model good behavior and educate people. But you set a good example, and you teach people it's okay to have friends from the other side, and you teach people to be patient and respectful. And to what Paul said, to enjoy the art of debate, to feel confident enough in your views that it's okay to have somebody tell you you're stupid. It's okay.
Anyone else? I want to make sure we get through questions. We have a few more minutes. Please.
Yeah, Richard Samp with the New Civil Liberties Alliance. We've been hearing a lot this morning about how it's important that both sides in the case get very effective advocacy. Half of the lawyers in this country are females. In my 40 years of litigation, I think that the female lawyers are just as good as the male lawyers that I've dealt with. All of the cases in the Supreme Court that I thought the arguments had been totally botched were all male attorneys. And I'm curious, we've been hearing about how the leadership of all the major law firms tends to be very liberal. They've got woke corporate clients. Why aren't there more Supreme Court advocates other than Lisa these days, other than the Solicitor General's office?
I mean, I think the answer is there are. This is, you know, I've sort of came late in life to the Supreme Court bar. I was a trial lawyer, period, when I became Solicitor General. And it was only as a result of coming back into private practice after that that people kept saying, like, why would we ever hire Seth Waxman to try a case? But the fact of the matter is that the character of the role and prevalence of women in litigation practices generally has changed so dramatically over the course of my professional life that I think the trajectory is the trajectory is extremely steep, and part of this is just generational, that you will see an increased percentage of appellate advocates, whether it's in the Supreme Court or otherwise, that are women, going up very consistently and in a very pronounced way over the course of the next many years.
Okay, I'm just going to dissent. That was preposterous. But this is really a conversation for another panel.
I mean, we had, my law firm, for example, had 5 Supreme Court arguments last term, and I was the only male who argued. We had 5 different lawyers argue. We had 4 women and 3 lawyers of color argue, and I think this is the shape of things to come.
Anything else? No? Okay. Please.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Greg Dolan at the University of Baltimore. And I was wondering, not that it's unimportant, but I was wondering how much of what we're discussing here today is really a problem of the elite. So the students that I teach, it's a regional law school, they're gonna end up, most of them, becoming public defenders, local ones, becoming state's attorney or assistant state's attorneys. They're gonna go work for medium-sized law firms, and they come to court, some are liberal, some are conservative, tend to be probably more on the liberal side, but they really come to court wanting to learn black letter law and ultimately practice it. They don't really take their politics into it. So I just wonder how much is this the problem of Harvard and Yale, right? And not so much things downstream. And if it's not, is that a sign of things to come, or is that perhaps something that we should feel maybe somewhat better about, that it doesn't affect all law schools and all practices?
Okay. Problem, is this a problem of elite law schools only, or is it a problem across the board in law schools? We've touched somewhat on the role of law schools in adding to this problem or causing the problem. Is it across the board?
I think, Judge, are you and I the only ones who went to state schools here?
I
you
think
mean
so.
In the whole room?
Maybe.
I went to Columbia, Lisa.
Okay.
And a school that beat Alabama last weekend.
I think it's a problem just at elite schools. Yes, I'm going to go ahead and say that. This is an elitism problem. I think that, maybe it's like this at University of Texas, but when I was there, people didn't care or fight about politics. Conservatives like liberals. It was fun. We argued in a good way. I only learned cancel culture from my kids who are at Ivy League schools.
So, I mean, let me take an intermediate position, which is, I mean, I think it's much more acute at sort of, you know, elite sort of law firms and elite law schools. I mean, you know, worrying a lot about whether you're going to get a job when you graduate has a certain disciplining effect. You know, you're not quite as worried about saving the world if you're just worried about, you know, saving your backside and paying back your loan and figuring out how you're going to do all that. So it is different. But I do think the whole legal profession takes its cues from some of these more sort of prominent elite institutions. They kind of dominate, you know, things like the American Bar Association. And so I do think it does sort of filter down. And, you know, and maybe one of the things that you can do sort of constructively, this is the Federalist Society after all, is at a state level to try to, I mean, you know, like, you know, the bar associations at the state level are not, you know, ripe for conservative capture. I get that. But I do think sort of, you know, at a more local level, kind of reaffirming for people, like, you know, that it's different to be a lawyer and kind of, you know, and reinforcing that. And maybe, you know, if the elite kind of top-down pressures are not healthy, then one way to try to deal with it is a little bit more from the grassroots up and kind of reaffirming that, you know, being a lawyer is supposed to be special. But, you know, as I was reminded last night as I was trying to desperately get an extra hour of ethics credit for Virginia, you know, being a lawyer is different. Everything you do, if it's criminal, can get you disbarred. So, you know, you can't, you know, it's like, you know, it's like Viet Dinh's conception of the presidency, which is you're president 24/7. You're a lawyer 24/7. It's a distinct view of life, and you have certain responsibilities that come with that. You are a professional. That's supposed to mean something. Like, I think sort of a little bit more of a grassroots kind of reminder of that could be useful.
Can I add just one very quick thing?
Please.
I think that there is a very real issue with the people who are coming out of the top institutions. I think there's no doubt that those students are predominantly liberal, but beyond that, I think that there is a real lack, frankly, of socioeconomic diversity, and I just sort of see it with my sort of hiring partner hat on when I look at the recruits who come through the door, and I worry about that. Now, Seth is going to tell me all the reasons why Harvard, in fact, hires a very diverse class on every conceivable axis, but I guess I just have my doubts on those two axes about the extent to which that's true. And if you look at the top law firms, rightly or wrongly, they are predominantly hiring from those top law schools.
Thank you.
Not to mention the Supreme Court.
I think we have time for one more question.
Oh, I'm sorry that it's me. Gary Lawson.
We're delighted it's you.
Happy
Lawson,
to have this last
Boston
question.
University School of Law. I mean, I've been a law professor for 35 years. So, of course, I know nothing about the practice of law. But I would guess that a lawyer who understands, truly understands the opposing position is likely, all else equal, to be a better lawyer than someone who doesn't. To what extent do law firms expressly consider that when they are making hiring decisions, taking into account the 7 years of miseducation that Paul Clement just talked about? If they openly said, we're going to hire people who genuinely understand opposing points of view, law schools would follow along, wagging their tails behind them, because they are businesses just as much as law firms are.
Maybe do those, I mean, so does anyone want to say, I mean, that sounds like an alternative universe to me. I mean,
I'm just wondering whether, I appreciate the comment, but I'm wondering whether it's consistent with your expressed either requirement or desire that it be really a question.
Fair enough. Well, on that note... I agree with Seth, and we are out of time. So I'd like us to thank this wonderful panel.
Very great.